Good afternoon, everybody. I picked time horizons / risk measures as my theme because it's a bit of a hobby horse of mine. And bearing in mind that although I am doing what I'm doing now, until 6 weeks ago I was as on the other side of the fence. It's a particular bugbear of mine that I think practitioners and regulators alike have really failed to define what we're trying to talk about when we look at the question of time horizon, first of all, in our capital modelling, and second, a question which I think is inextricably linked with time horizon, and that is the way we define our risk appetite. So I sort of picked that up as my hobby horse, and I sort of grabbed that when we put the paper together, and also when I had the opportunity to stand up and ask some questions and facilitate a discussion as we're doing here today. That was the one that I really wanted to get hold of. So I've got a few things to show you. First of all, just, I guess, praising what's in the paper for those of you who haven't been reading it every night since it was published. And then second, just a little bit of analysis, some observations and possibly some questions to the audience, depending on how lively the discussion already is by then. So the themes that I wanted to bring out under those two headings, first of all, under the time horizon, how much new underwriting activity should we be considering when we're setting capital requirements for a business? And this is, I suppose, thinking from a regulatory perspective, but bearing in mind that capital requirements are considered for a number of reasons and not just regulatory reasons. How far, once we've established which liabilities we're considering, how far do we project those liabilities before we decide that the risk is trivial or not worth bothering with? And the third aspect of time horizon, which I think is just as important as those two points, is projection of future capital requirements. So it isn't just a case of knowing how much capital you need now, according to whatever criteria, but it's also a very good idea to have a view on how much you're going to need in the future and where that might come from. And then on the question of risk appetite, I guess the big one is the equivalence or otherwise of different impairment probabilities over different periods, where that whole theme has come from, and what we're actually trying to compare an insurance product with. I think a lot of analogies are drawn with bonds, but I question whether that is necessarily the right analogy. So I'd be interested to hear views on that. And also, since a lot of models seem to work from one balance sheet to the next, there's this question about continuing solvency, or a proxy for continuing solvency, being interim solvency tests. So if you're looking over a 5-year time horizon, should you be looking every year in that period, every month, or continuously? Plenty of room at the front. So turning first to new underwriting, I should say, by the way, stop me anytime you want, because I'm not just intending to talk for 25 minutes, and I hope someone has some feedback on these points. What aspects should we be considering when we decide how long we project for, how much new business we take into account? And here are some ideas that I've seen coming up. For example, does the new underwriting activity bring capital strain? Now, I think in most general insurance applications, it's difficult to come up with a plausible example where a whole year, say, of underwriting activity would not increase your capital requirements. But it's an interesting check to make before you start launching into a 3-year projection when the business is projected to be so profitable that it actually reduces your capital requirements substantially. When will the plan be updated? I think a lot of businesses tend to work to an annual planning cycle. They may project for 3 or 5 years, but they're updating at least annually, possibly every half year or quarter. So there's an opportunity at some point in the future to revise your business plan, to revise your capital plan, to think about other sources of capital. So why do we actually need to hold capital now for events that might happen in 5 years' time, given that we've got at least four opportunities to change the position by the time we get there. Obviously, the next question that leads from that is, what plan is there for raising new capital? So there's no point ignoring the future if you are not going to take those opportunities to do something about it. And then I think particular thorny questions where my personal feeling is that in setting out capital requirements from a regulatory perspective, we haven't really dealt properly with what we're worrying about and what the solution is to that worry. And the two areas I've noted there, the underwriting cycle and correlations between underwriting years, are particularly important to me. Take, for example, a firm that believes it will have lower profitability throughout the cycle has a five-year projection, for example. Now, why does it feel that a five-year projection is a good idea? Just because it will have lower profitability, lower expected profitability, I should stress, throughout the underwriting cycle. And then, if you have strong correlations between underwriting years, liability business, where it takes a long time for experience to feed through, means that you may be under-reserving over a period of time. You may also be underpricing over a period of time before you realise that you've done that. Does that mean we actually need to project 5 years new business to take that effect into account? So they're questions that I think need to be addressed by us as practitioners, but also by our stakeholders and, from my point of view, by the regulators. And I think I picked up on the how quickly we can react point. So there's some aspects of underwriting and how much new business to take into account. Can I pause there, because I've said probably more than my 5 minute slot already, and just see if there's any reaction, anybody wants to pick up on those points before we move on. Okay.
Can I just lob in a question? Not a question, any comments? By coincidence, Tony's firm, the FSA, they published a document in January this year. I've forgotten the exact title. I think it was called Strengthening Capital Standards. And it said it was written for banks. So a lot of us might not have looked into it. And the other reason we might not have looked into it was 438 pages long. However, there were two chapters which advertised themselves as being of interest to insurance companies, and they made some quite firm statements on banks, but then at the end of the paragraph said, reminded us that one day they want to bring banking supervision and insurance supervision close together in style, and this very point of projecting your capital requirements, now for the banks they said throughout a business cycle, i.e. a credit cycle, but the wording was very strong. And I can't ask Tony, because I promise we won't ask him tough questions, but if that principle is taken across to insurance firms, we will get very tough requirements to explain how we're going to capitalise ourselves throughout the cycle. And that, I see that as an issue that will come back to us again and again from the policymakers at the FSA.
And the challenge is, do we think that's the right thing to do? Let's forget what any regulator might be saying we should be doing. Do we think that's the right thing to do from a capital modelling perspective? If we do, then fine. If we don't, then we should be putting evidence together to the fact that, or to support the fact that we shouldn't be doing it. Henry. We've got a mic coming down.
From Lloyds. I wonder if the situation we find ourselves in might be a way into thinking about it, which is that Lloyds, of course, people at the moment anyway, capitalise for 1 year at a time, and yet going forward we will be looking for businesses to produce a multi-year ICA. Now, partly that's because the FSA requires that for everybody and we want to be good citizens, but it's not just for that reason. We think it's very good practice, and it's around some of the things you said about in a softening market, it might take a while for your reserving to react to the reality. You might not realise it first, and you might therefore underprice for a while. And also, it takes a while for the plan to be updated. This is very sibilant, is it? I feel as I'm.
I thought that was just you.
Anyway, I'll have to put up with it. And it's about, part of our thinking was that there can be some optimism in setting ICAs, and if you require people to take a longer term view, then that makes it much more difficult for them not to confront the reality that a hard market turns into a softer market. And so at the particular time we began to implement this work, the market was hard, still is, it's widely believed to be, it was hard. And we wanted to make sure that people took account of the fact that it's likely to soften. And that was one of the benefits. So it's a very practical, it's not really got any particular theoretical argument of the kind that you were giving. But I think in practice, one of the big risks in insurance is around optimism. We all know that, and we all suffer from it, or at least I certainly do. I know that I'm in the insurance industry, and therefore I will suffer from the delay in recognising bad news that the industry suffers from. And by forcing people to take a longer-term view, you are making it much more likely that they will confront themselves, and if they won't confront themselves, then the regulator, or in Lloyd's case, we can confront them with the reality that there's always been a soft cycle after the hard cycle before. And so you need to confront it, and that might just, as I say, it's rather a practical reason.
Does anyone want to react to that before I do?
I'd like to.
Mr. Chairman?
It's not just the regulators, though, as well. If you think of the shareholders, they've got a net asset value in your company, and they've got a value of future profits. And the value of future profits, they want to know how that's going to fluctuate over the next couple of years and how they're going to finance it. So it seems to me, even in your one-year venture, you've got a team there of underwriters, and they've got a franchise value because they've got clients coming to them. And if whoever participates in the profits of that business, they want it to run ahead 4 or 5 years successfully. So I think those guys want to know the longer-term view as well, not just the regulators.
I think I've been thinking quite a lot about this, and both of the views that I've just heard put forward to me are arguments for having a model or a modelling process that does look sufficiently far forward to take those things into account, but not necessarily an argument for determining a figure, a capital number that takes that time horizon into account. I think there's a distinction for me between being aware of what might happen in the future and recognising the optimism built into what you're doing, and bringing everything forward to time zero and making sure that it's on the balance sheet now. Okay, I'll move on to... Nope, Roger at the back.
Roger Jackson from Deloitte. I just thought to another point that might be useful here is along the lines of, if we want to try to embed these models into firms a little bit more than they are currently, then it's a good idea to align them to the business plan, which might be 3 to 5 years, for example, and therefore that might be a very good way of reason why a particular firm might want to have a multi-year model that goes out 3 or 5 years. The other point I was going to make was that I guess there's a difference from, there possibly could be a difference between a model, how you set it up from a regulatory point of view as opposed to a shareholder point of view. The actual model structure might be the same, but the key outputs might be different for those two exercises as well. I guess from a shareholder point of view, as Andrew said, that you've got the future value of the business, but from a regulatory point of view, you'll think of it more as how much capital do I need now, and that from a going concern point of view, is that capital sufficient going forward, given the 5-year, 3-year business plan that you have in place, and then taking into account any of the processes, i.e. raising capital or whatever, that may be available to you.
At the risk of just using this platform to make sure I always have the last word on any topic, I think my take on what Roger's just said is that, as with most of the models that we're using, a multitude of purposes for the models, and the way you do your capital modelling will depend on what you're going to use the results of the capital modelling for. So I guess I get a little bit too distracted these days about the regulatory side of things. But one thing I would say is that if you're taking an approach to your regulatory capital modelling that may be giving a higher number than an alternative approach, which is equally plausible, and you believe that there is a cost attached to holding more regulatory capital than less, I think you should be thinking seriously about these points. Right, I will move on, because otherwise Andrew's going to pull me off. The projection, so given that you've got liabilities, existing liabilities, and liabilities arising from some new underwriting, what do you do in terms of projecting those liabilities? How long do you assume they're on the balance sheet when you're considering the risk associated with them? There's a consensus, certainly among the general insurance professionals that I speak to, that we should be considering risk, certainly insurance risk, associated with those liabilities until they're met. So if you've got a cash flow type model, you're running off the liabilities on the books, you should be running off all of the cash flows and considering the risk associated with all of them. A proxy for that that's been proposed in a number of areas is that we should consider a notional transfer at some future point. So you allow for the actual cash flows and the risk associated with those for 1, 3, 5 years, but at the end of that period you assume that there's some notional counterparty. You come up with some kind of, let me call it a reinsurance to close premium that you would use to exhaust those liabilities and pass them across. And that would feed back into the time zero capital calculations. So that really, the two approaches would not give the same answer, other than by accident, I believe. So it'd be interesting to hear views on what actually is a practicable thing. And if you're thinking from it purely from a policyholder point of view, if the capital is there just to protect policyholders, what sort of protection is it that they deserve, that they're looking for? Is it protection from the full exhaustion of the liabilities? Is it projection from, you know, getting most of their liabilities paid until some unspecified point in the future when it's probably less important? I don't know. And then sort of practical considerations, if you are projecting forwards, under what circumstances do you assume the cash flows are occurring? So do you have a notional closure of the portfolio once the new business stops coming in? Do you assume the business truly goes into runoff and take into account the expense implications of that? Or do you consider other scenarios whereby the business may be a going concern and you are just taking a contribution to expenses and allowing for those? Which other risks should be considered as the liabilities are run off? Got asset risk still. You probably got some aspects of operational risk, although only a subset of operational risk, given that you're no longer underwriting. Those need to be taken into account as well. And then finally, if you have a multi-year contract, assuming that you are closing the projection at some future point, what happens if you still got contracts that you wrote last year which aren't completely expired at that point? Is there a difference between an unearned premium reserve and an outstanding claims reserve when it comes to doing these capital projections? I want to show you a picture and I want to describe what's in that picture first of all. This will be the last thing that I say about this topic. One of the problems that's been bothering me over the past few weeks is this question about the projection of liabilities and the interaction between the time horizon, i.e. how long you allow the liabilities to run for, and the confidence level that you're applying when you're setting capital requirements. So I've knocked together a simple model of the runoff of some liabilities. Arbitrary cash flows over 10 years. Cash flows are stochastic in nature, backed by assets that are represented by a simple stochastic investment model. And then looked at, for each cash flow simulation, the present value of that cash flow based on the investment scenarios that we see. And I've considered the actual cash flows and investment returns up to an arbitrary point T. And the particular example, I think I've used 5 years. And then beyond T, we have different ways of valuing the outstanding liabilities. So I've tried to do, I think, what you might see in a typical DFA model. There's an approach which essentially allows for perfect foresight. So it just continues to project in each simulation the actual cash flows and the actual returns and uses that to present value. That's what I've called the ultimate model. Ultimate in liability terms, not in in quality terms. An approach that uses prior assumptions, which I think is analogous to a Bornhitter-Ferguson type approach, and an approach that responds to experience. So if you get more cash flows early on than expected, your reserves would go up as well, which I think is analogous to the way a chain ladder model might work. And then measuring the capital requirements coming out of those liabilities, arbitrarily subtracting the amount at a given percentile from the best estimate to define the capital requirement, is done using different impairment criteria and probabilities. So the picture itself is showing percentile plots. So each one of those sort of groups of grey lines with coloured blobs on is a different percentile plot coming out of a different approach to setting the reserves at my arbitrary point T. So the grey lines just represent percentiles, just to give you an impression of the fanning out of the capital requirements. The red blobs are the expectation. So in most cases, you can see that the expected present value of the capital requirements is zero, given that I've subtracted the expected present value of the liabilities from the total to get there. The black triangles are the 99.5% confidence level, to give us an idea of where the extremes are going. And the blue diamonds are the 97.5% confidence level, which, given that this is a five-year projection, is intended to be equivalent to what I think a number of people would assume you would use with a five-year time horizon. The first model, the ultimate model, is, I suppose, to all intents and purposes, the correct answer, if you allow for the fact that all we're aiming to do is meet policyholders' requirements as and when they fall due. And actually, if you looked at that cross-section at any future time point, you get exactly the same picture. The time horizon is irrelevant in that case. The next three lines represent a projection over that five-year time horizon without making interim solvency checks. So we're only interested in the position at the end of 5 years, not in any interim position. And the observations that you would make there, actually I'll have to move on to my next slide before I can make the observations because I can't remember what they are. So just park that one for the moment. So you've got the three lines without the interim solvency checks. And then finally the three lines with exactly equivalent to those with interim solvency checks. The first one is our perfect foresight model, which actually is exactly equivalent to the ultimate projection. So if you're imagining yourself reserving in the future with perfect foresight, there's no difference between that and a runoff model, which kind of refutes the argument for I can't do a runoff model because my model works on balance sheets. The emerging experience ones are what happens if you allow for emerging experience. So that's your basic chain ladder approach to future reserving, which, as you would expect, gives you a slightly more volatile picture in this case. And then prior expectations is the converse, because you are damping the effect of emerging experience by basing your future reserves on your original expectations, you tend to have a narrower range. So, just to close, my observation is based on that little model. First of all, the expected capital is zero whenever you have or whenever you don't have interim solvency checks. But if you observe the red blobs to the right-hand side of that graph, whenever you introduce interim solvency checks, your actual capital requirement, even if you're basing it on the expectation rather than a given percentile, would tend to be higher, all other things being equal. And I think Trevor nailed the explanation for that one for me. I think it's equivalent to an American option being worth more than a European option, or the other way around. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, derivatives are a bit rusty. Which, you know, in terms of what we're doing, if you've got a, you know, you've built your model and it's based on balance sheets, etc., and you're doing these interim solvency checks, you're actually introducing an upwards bias in your capital requirements by doing it this way. Even if you think you're damping down the effect by using a Bornhutter-Ferguson type reserving approach in your projections, which was an interesting thought for me. As I said, the perfect foresight reserving approach is just the same as modelling with runoff. So it's quite easy to construct a model that imagines reserving in the future, which is exactly equivalent to running off completely. And then depending on what you're doing with your reserving approach, you can either damp the capital requirements down or exaggerate them. And it really depends on what the balance you've got between your prior assumptions and experience and your notional future reserving. But the key conclusion, which is something that I think a lot of people have discussed ad nauseam, is that modelling to 97.5% over 5 years is not equivalent to 99.5% over 1 year, and there's no way of knowing whether it will be stronger or weaker.